We'll call the House Tax Committee meeting toward the hour of 10:15 having arrived. And for everyone that is here, we have a situation where we have about 18,000 committees going on all at the same time. So we will try to get to a quorum because there is, it'd be my intention to take up House File 2093 first if the author gets here. Okay. We will hear his bill. As soon as we have a quorum, then we will officially take action. But the only bill that we'll actually be acting on today, as far as moving it to the general register, if it has the votes needed, would be the House File 2093, the Sanders bill. And then I will just go down in order according to the agenda. Let's go with Representative Sanders. When we have a quorum, I'll move your bill. But if you could describe your bill to the committee. And again, we're operating a little shorthanded. We will not take any action until we officially have a quorum established. So with that, Representative Sanders, I will move House File 2093 when we have a quorum. If you could please describe what your bill does.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. This House File 2093, the reason why we're in front of the Taxes Committee is we are repealing the 2% withholding that was in place as a part of the ICEC, Independent Contractor Program, that we are repealing in this bill. We are repealing that part, the statute as well, and we are going with a new pilot project in attempts to clean up some of the issues going on in the construction industry, dealing with most of the time subs, make sure that they're all registered, paying their taxes, their unemployment insurance, workers' comp, and so on down the road. So one of the things that was kind of a catalyst for pushing a lot of construction companies or subs underground, if you will, was part of this 2% withholding. To get around that, a lot of companies are filing LLCs. In attempts to kind of put everything back the way that it probably should be, in hopes that everything will work, that these companies will register correctly with the Department of Revenue, DALI, and the Secretary of State's office, we are also repealing this 2% withholding. That was something that was really pushed by the task force members. They didn't repeal it last year because they said that there wasn't enough data. However, I think if the Department of Revenue wants to weigh in or not, but it just sounds like it just wasn't really working or having the effect that they thought it would have. So that's why we're here.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. Is there anyone that wishes to testify on behalf of the Sanders bill or with concerns thereof? Any questions from members at this point? If House Fiscal could please come to the table and go over, Ms. Templin, if you could please identify yourself for the record and go over the consolidated fiscal note on House File 2093.
Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal staff. You should have the fiscal note for House File 2093, the second engrossment, in front of you. And what you see on the cover page there are a total of $168,000 in fiscal 13 of estimated cost for this proposal. Just going over the first year, the Department of Revenue shows $16,000 in administrative costs and $105,000 in estimated revenue reduction from tax compliance from this proposal. I just want to, again, reiterate that the $105,000 is just due to tax compliance, and it's not because of a change in tax liability. In addition to that, there are non-general fund costs to the building code fund, also shown on this fiscal note. And the cost in fiscal 14 and 15 are $142,000 in fiscal 14 and $114,000 in fiscal 15.
Thank you, Ms. Templin. I'll officially call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Bills moves the minutes of March 22nd. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Bills. Okay, I will move House File 2093 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Sanders and members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee.
Now, members, that was, as I stated at the beginning, that's the only one we'll actually be taking action on today. We'll be hearing bills now for possible, that'll be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome to the committee, Chair Hoppe. I will move House File 2850. Representative Hoppe, let me just get, if I could, before you give a brief description of the bill, or it doesn't have to be brief, you can be as long as it wants. We have a Mr. John Peterson that would like to make comments on this bill, and also a Mr. Kelleher from the Historical Society. So after we've had a presentation of the bill, is there anyone else that would like to address this bill?
Mr. Chair?
Chair Hoppe.
I'm not sure. I think it's still being debated, but I think Mr. Bagnoli would like to speak in favor of the bill as well.
Okay. Okay, if you could please describe your bill, and then we'll take testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I will be brief. I always try to be brief. I'll be even more brief because others can speak more to the tax implications of the bill. I'm here because there was a project that, in my estimation, everybody seems to agree, the Historical Society in SHPO, the City of St. Paul, everybody seems to like the project for the Minnesota building and think that it should have qualified for a historic tax credit. And it did not. I'm not an attorney, and I'm not expert in historic buildings. It seems to be a misinterpretation for that particular project. That's what got me interested. I do like historical buildings. But with that, I will bring Mr. Kelleher up here and let him explain about the program in more detail. And then Mr. Bagnoli and Mr. Peterson could talk more about the specifics of the bill that's before the Tax Committee.
Mr. Kelleher, if you could state your name and who represents the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. One of the units within the Minnesota Historical Society is the State Historic Preservation Office, which administers the State Historic Tax Credit Program along with the Department of Revenue. I'll just make a couple of very brief comments about the program in general and save some of my comments for Thursday when you'll be hearing Representative Quam's bill on the same program. Where it might be more appropriate to do a general overview of how the programs run. And in brief, the program has been very, very successful. When the bill passed in 2010, you asked us at the Minnesota Historical Society to do an economic impact study. We worked with the University of Minnesota Extension to complete that study, which we delivered to you in November. And in brief, the program has been successful. There have been thousands of jobs created, and dozens of projects have gotten started under this program that would not have otherwise happened. And the evidence is that under the federal program for the previous couple of years, there had been between one and four of these projects that had taken advantage of the federal tax credit, and now there are a couple of dozen projects in the pipeline to be completed. The bill before you today contains some technical revisions to the law that outlines the historic tax credit and a couple of substantive changes. And I'll just say in brief that we have had some discussions with the Department of Revenue and the folks who brought the bill forward. We have a couple of concerns. We want to make sure we get the language right. And if you'll give us the permission to keep working and keep the discussions going, I'm not sure specifically where this bill is going, but if a little bit more time, we'll make sure that we get it right and make sure that the program works.
Thank you. Hoppe?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. With that, we have, I'm not sure if Mr. Bagnoli wants to come down. If not, we can go to Mr. Peterson.
Okay, first of all, Mr. Kelleher, if you could stick around just a second. Are there any questions for Mr. Kelleher from the Historical Society? Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe if we're going to have a more extensive hearing later in the week, we could address that, but I'm just interested in the contested case process. It seems like we're changing the process by which buildings are determined, and I just want to understand that a little bit better, since obviously the tax advantage is why people are doing this.
Mr. Kelleher?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, the change that's within this bill on the contested case, that section of the bill, corrects a I don't know if I'd call it an oversight. There's really not a process for someone who has a question, a disagreement on the eligibility of a project to appeal. There are other parts of the federal historic preservation law, and you'll remember that this was designed to parallel the federal historic preservation program. There are mechanisms in place for eligibility for the National Register, eligibility for the federal credit, but in the state program, there's really not a way for someone to appeal. So the language in here addresses that. We want to make sure that the language is written tightly so that it doesn't weave into some of those federal things that I just mentioned, like eligibility for the National Register, which have their own processes. So that's one of the areas of this bill that we want to see the language tightened up a little bit. And as I mentioned, we have been working closely with Revenue and with the gentleman who will testify in a second to make sure that we get the language right.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, just to that
Jim
point,
Hoppe.
I think, thank you, Mr. Chair, I think what initially got me interested in this is it seems to be that there was one project out of four or five, I don't recall how many, that didn't get selected. And as Mr. Kelleher said, it seemed, I don't want to use the word arbitrary, but it seemed like it was a little bit of a floating target. And there were projects that were in the pipeline, as they say, and I think the determination was, had work been done on the project before a certain date or not, and it depends on what you define by work and who did it and what was going on. So I guess looking for clarification. And with that, maybe we should bring up Mr. Peterson.
A couple of questions. First, Representative Loeffler, are you okay?
I'm done. Thank you.
Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hoppe, my question related to the answer that you just gave. This is specific regarding the Minnesota building. Who is the owner or the developer on that now?
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh. I honestly don't actually know. I think Mr. Peterson could speak to that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, the reason I ask is the Minnesota building is like some racehorse with great potential that causes bankruptcies for successive owners, I think. I don't know how many people have tried to rehab that building over the course of 20 years, but I've known several who it's not worked out for. And obviously, if this was a sticking point, and I know this is only a recent enactment that we're doing this, but I appreciate you bringing forward, so maybe Mr. Peterson can answer the question about who's going to do it.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. First of all, Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And maybe someone could quickly explain Chapter 14. How does that work? I see it's referred to contested case procedure in Chapter 14. Just if someone could tell me how that process works quickly.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Marquardt, I am not a tax expert, and maybe Mr. Michael could explain that, or Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Marquardt, the Chapter 14 is the General Administrative Procedures Act, and the contested case process is not a tax-specific process. The tax processes have a separate appeals provision for tax decisions. This, I think the thinking on this is it is more on the nature of a normal administrative decision. And so it's sort of a, as I understand it, and I'm not, because we don't usually use it in the tax arena very much, I'm not that familiar with it, but there's an Office of Administrative Hearings that has a cadre of judges, administrative judges, that hear cases. It's sort of like litigation, but it's got a much more simplified and user-friendly process than classic civil litigation. And I believe that those decisions are then, in turn, appealable, typically to the agency head and then on to the Court of Appeals.
Thank you. Mr. Marquardt? Representative Runbeck?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hoppe, this sounds like it's opening up this, what had been more or less of an administrative process, opening it up to the courts. Is that something we really want to do?
Mr. Kelleher? Or Representative Hoppe? Mr. Kelleher?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, the reason for adding this section of the bill is to create an avenue if there is a disagreement within the administrative process. The administrative process would govern probably 99% of the projects that go through this process, but if there is a disagreement, it offers an option. I'm with Representative Hoppe. I don't know a lot about what would happen, but presumably if there was a disagreement, it could be taken to district court. But this creates a simpler, as Mr. Michael described, a simpler avenue for resolving disagreements.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Rumbeck. That's the intention here, is to give a little bit more clarity and guidance for future projects down the road, and the hope is that there are fewer lawsuits because of this.
Representative Rumbeck.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Kelleher? Thank you very much, Mr. Kelleher. Okay, we'll now go to Mr. John Peterson. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir, and then provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Peterson. I'm an attorney with Winthrop & Weinstein, and I represent MNB Development and Minnesota Vistas and Minnesota Place and Minnesota Park, which are the three owners of the current owners of the Minnesota building. Members of the committee, I'm here to just provide a brief outline of the requested changes to the statute and why, from the development community's perspective, these changes are important. The changes really fall into two different types of buckets. The first is in the nature of making the statute more consistent with the federal statute upon which it piggybacks, the second of which is to provide some clarifying provisions to provisions of the statute that otherwise are what we feel ambiguous. The Section 290.0681 provides a 20% historic tax credit that's available in the same amount and to the same extent that the federal historic tax credit is also available. So as Mr. Kelleher mentioned earlier, there were a fairly limited number of federal historic projects that had been in the pipeline in Minnesota prior to the enactment of this credit. And since the enactment of the credit, there have been many more that have come forward. And the purpose of the statute certainly seems to be being accomplished through the activities of the development community. The problem, though, is that a number of the terms that are currently in the statute differ from the federal statute. So developers and tax practitioners were unclear as to exactly which costs would be qualifying for the credit and which wouldn't. So we've mirrored a number of the terms in the statute to the terms that are fairly well established on the federal side, so that the development community and SHPO and Department of Revenue all are kind of speaking from the same voice. And to my knowledge, all of those clarifying provisions are, there's no disagreement among the development community or SHPO or the Division of Revenue. The second section of provisions that the proposed amendment seeks to clarify really deal with both the contested case procedures that were just discussed and then the effective date language as to which projects would qualify at the time the statute was enacted and which projects would not qualify. There's been a fair amount of discussion already on the contested case procedures, and I'd be happy to take any questions, but as was earlier discussed, the idea is to provide a streamlined method of addressing any controversies that may arise through decisions through the State Historic Preservation Office in a non-court fashion. The idea of the Administrative Procedure Act is to require people to exhaust all administrative remedies and avoid the courts to the extent possible and work things out with the respective agencies. And that's what the goal of using the contested case procedures under the Administrative Procedure Act would be. The last item that we're seeking to have clarified is the effective date language. And the effective date language is ambiguous currently in the sense that it's just not tightly worded enough to identify which projects are qualifying for the project, or excuse me, for the credit at the time the statute was enacted and which projects were not. I represent the developers of the Minnesota building, so that's obviously the project that's of most importance for my clients. But there are other clients that are other projects that this could potentially create some ambiguity on as well, both in terms of qualifying or not qualifying for the credit. We believe that the current fiscal note that is presented as with some language that we're working with the SHPO on would be tightened up, and in fact, because these costs were intended to be part of the program from the outset, really the fiscal note should be a zero fiscal note. And it's my understanding that the current credit expenditure is less than what was initially budgeted. With that, I have no further.
Okay, we'll open up for questions here. And we will, after, I think what we'll do after Mr. Peterson's done, before we go to Mr. Bagnoli, I'd like to have House Research look at the revenue note here. Is there anyone that has come in the audience that wishes to testify with concerns on this bill? Okay, we'll get to you, and I just wanted to see. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, would you restate again that the LLCs you represent for the developers?
Yes.
What are the names?
Sure.
Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, the names of the parties that currently own the three condominium units in the Minnesota building are Minnesota Vistas LLC, Minnesota Place LLC, and Minnesota Park LLC.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Peterson, who are the primary principals in these entities?
Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, the primary developer is Leo Sand and John Belisle.
Representative Lesh?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, my question relates to the criteria by which you were either excluded or what, which others are excluded. And Representative Hoppe mentioned this had to do something to do with their basis for whether work was done previously on this or not. So did you, were you ostensibly disqualified based on the fact that the work had been done on the project before, or work had not been done on the project before the date of the enactment?
Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, the issue that is arising is that we have a construction contract signed after the effective date pursuant to which the work was being done. There was some prior work that had been done as well by the contractor, but that was not under contract with the ultimate owners. And so SHPO has looked at some of the prior work that was done under a that wasn't contracted for by the ultimate owners, and determined that that work should disqualify the project.
Okay. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, and Representative Lesh and members, I think what happened is the project developers were very careful, because the reason that they're doing this, as to Representative Lesh's earlier point about this building, I'm not a developer, but I think that the reason it works is because, you know, ultimately they want it to succeed, but the reason it works is because of the tax credit. So I think they were very careful and very specific to not do any work before the date. They knew what the dates were going to be. They didn't want to do anything that was going to put in jeopardy their potential tax credit. And I think it's my understanding of it, again, is that it was a misinterpretation by the people from SHPO that went and looked at the project.
Okay. Thank
you, Mr.
Chair. Other questions for Mr. Peterson? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you. And Mr. Peterson, I understand you're representing one of the projects, but do you know what the other five projects that would be impacted by the retroactivity would be?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, we have had extensive discussions on a very friendly basis with SHPO over the last week or two, and are intending to work with them to narrow the scope of the proposed effective date language to just the single project.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it, just in terms of your project, just refreshing myself on how this works, the grants that are granted, do they get allocated and the cost to the state at the time of allocation, or is it when, since the bill authorizes transferring of the grants between various parties, even retroactively transferring grants, will that have future implications for the state's budget or into future years?
Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, this particular, there are two avenues for providing funds for a project under the statute, one of which is through the issuance of a credit certificate. The other is the application for and receipt of a grant. this particular project has applied for a credit certificate rather than a grant. But to your question, which I think is really the cost, this should not have any future impact on the state's budget.
Representative Loeffler?
Thank you. I'll wait till we hear the discussion of the fiscal note.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hoppe.
Well, I will add one thing. I have not been part of the conversations between the project developer and the Historical Society in Chippo, but with my dealings with both Mr. Kelleher, this is Historical Society in Chippo, they've been supportive and very nice to work with. And I think everybody wants the project to go forward. It seems like, you know, the meetings seem to be going well from what I hear. And I think Chippo's done a nice job of, you know, really helping out with the discussion here and trying to come to a reasonable conclusion.
Okay, let's go to Ms. Von Mosch from the department. We're going to mix it up a little bit here. We'll go to the department. Let's get some, they have some concerns. Let's get those on the table. Then we'll go to a House Fiscal, then Mr. Bagnoli. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name and who you represent, please.
Thank you. Susan Von Mosch from the Department of Revenue.
And welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My comments are really focused on the issue that is related to the assignability of the tax credit, and it is highlighted in the revenue estimate down toward the bottom, in that this proposal on page 3 allows for the tax credit, right? The current law has the tax credit being transferred once, and revenue did do a revenue notice in March, revenue notice 12-06, that put forth our position on the transfer of the credits. And this provision would allow the credits to be transferred in whole or in part up to 3 times without the consent of the commissioner. And our concern is that it's an administrative concern that if this was enacted, we would have a very difficult time really tracking who's a rightful owner of a credit and how would they be tracked, and especially if a second owner of the credit can then further split the credit and transfer it again. And again, it's that kind of administrative concern. We have been working with the Historical Society and with the other individuals involved, and I think we're working out some good language. I think they were unaware of our revenue notice, and there is an ability in the revenue notice to do flow through if there is a type of unitary group or partnership, and I think that helps ease some of the concerns that the project involved. But I just wanted to get on record that this is a concern, but I think that we can work together to get it resolved.
Thank you. Representative Hoppe?
Mr. Chair, when I said nice things about Chippo a minute ago, I might have inadvertently excluded the Department of Revenue, and I would also like to include them and say nice things about them.
Well, they're nice, but you said Mr. Kelleher was nice, but does he support this? He's nice either way, whether you support something or doesn't. He's just
Mr. Chair, I think everybody supports coming to a peace in the valley type conclusion.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Von Mosch? Thank you very much, Ms. Von Mosch. Ms. Templin, if you could please go over the revenue note for the committee, please.
Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. I'm looking at the revenue estimate for House File 2850, dated March 19, 2012. In the first year, this proposal is estimated to have a revenue loss of $7.6 million in Fiscal 13 and $100,000 in Fiscal 14. And this estimate is driven by the retroactivity of the change in the effective date, making it retroactive. And the department estimates that with the changes to the effective date, that an additional 6 projects will be picked up with the new effective date language. And that's it.
Questions for Ms. Templin? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Templin, given that the bill would authorize the transferring of the credit, mm-hmm. If it's transferred to others, will they necessarily collect it in these particular fiscal years? I mean, it seems to me it's sort of as I recall, the credit holds its value. It doesn't terminate in that particular year. Is that correct?
Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, the transferability, it's my understanding, if it's transferred once or transferred twice, that it's the value is the same. The taxpayer isn't getting the credit three times, or the transferability doesn't affect the revenue estimate.
Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe it wasn't clear. I was just wondering whether or not the transferability would actually impact our ability to predict when it would be taken against, you know, as a revenue loss, as against earned income, or you'd have to transfer it three times. If you're going to transfer it up to the maximum three times, you'd have to do it within that fiscal year. Or can you, can the holder of the credit decide to apply it against, you know, taxable earnings at a different fiscal year, and so it would make our projection of cash flow more difficult.
Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, with the information that I know, the value of the, you know, once the tax credit is transferred, you can no longer claim it again, so that wouldn't have a revenue impact. If it's transferred once and then it is claimed, then the credit, there's no more revenue loss from the credit.
Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understood that. I just wondered about the timing, if the transfer might put it into a different fiscal year, for example.
Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, that I can find out.
Representative Loeffler?
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions for Ms. Templin? Thank you very much, Ms. Templin. I have one person left to testify, Mr. Bagnoli. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Joe Bagnoli. I'm here, I guess, on behalf of my law firm and as a citizen and as a friend of Representative Hoppe. I'm here just to testify in favor of this bill. Our law firm represents a number of developers that have successfully used this. We've seen it. As has been testified, this is a growing area that's really helped put a lot of older buildings back in service and develop jobs. I have no comment on Representative Lesh's point in this particular building owner in St. Paul. As to the conforming portions of the other portions of the bill that had to do with conformity to federal law, I think those are good and was here to support it.
Questions for Mr. Bagnoli? Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe this question is for Mr. Bagnoli or Mr. Keller or Mr. Peterson. I'm still trying to wrap my head around exactly how this, how these historic preservation credits work. I'm curious as to whether there are any government funds that are going to be impacted by this bill. Are we going to see incentives for additional historic developments using legacy funds or other funds, or are these simply private sector developments in which private sector people are fixing old buildings and bringing them up to speed? It appears that the answer is the latter, but I just want to confirm that, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kelleher, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society, and Representative Draskowski. These are largely private sector developments done by for-profit corporations. These buildings are old and challenging to redevelop, and they sometimes need a little extra help to make the numbers add up. And that's what we're seeing happen with the first couple years of this program.
Representative Hoppe. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Keller.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Draskowski. I don't think that this bill is going to make any more developers take on more historical projects. It's not going to make any less either. I think it's just going to clarify some of the language around it. But it shouldn't result in any more or less projects being considered for these grants or credits.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions of Mr. Keller? Okay, if you want to wrap it up, thank you, Mr. Keller. Representative Hoppe, if you want to wrap it up.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I appreciate your time this morning, and thanks for letting us talk more about this. It remains, with revenue and SHPO and the developers, I think it remains a work in progress, and I think it's moving in the right direction. And thanks for your time.
Thank you, Representative Hoppe. I will move that House File 2850 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank House you, File 2773, I will move House File 2773 for possible inclusion in an omnibus tax bill. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If we have an amendment to the bill, could Representative Atkins, could you please tell us what the amendment does? I will move the A1 amendment, if you could please describe it.
Thank you, and I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate, I won't try to pretend, Mr. Chairman, that this is a simple topic, but you grasped it when I visited with you about it previously in just a couple minutes. And it, the amendment does exactly what the bill does, but it's drafted in a better fashion with the help from our tax staff and advisor folks. They just found that it was a little bit more of an appropriate way to frame the issue. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to walk you through what the bill does.
Generally, in tax committee, we like to get the bill in the shape the author would like, so I'll move the H2773E1 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, to the bill as amended. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that. This is, and I'm joined, by the way, to my right by Captain Adler from Delta Airlines. He's here to pick up the pieces of whatever I mess up here today. When the previous, the predecessor to Delta Airlines, Northwest Airlines, had its issues back in the mid-2000s, there were some folks, some employees of Northwest, that were entitled to payments as a result of the bankruptcy. Those payments, when they were made, were categorized as ordinary income. They were filed in Delta, or I should say Northwest employees' tax returns as ordinary income. Since then, and very recently, the Federal Aviation Authority, or FAA Reauthorization Act, was approved by Congress. Went into effect and had a provision in it that applied specifically to Northwest employees and others similarly situated who were faced by those bankruptcy issues and had some issues in the mid-2000s, allowing those folks to take what had previously been identified as ordinary income on which they filed their taxes, paid taxes on ordinary income, and allowing that to be recategorized as IRA, as retirement income. With the customized tax committee, I don't have to explain to you the advantages of what would have one's ability to be able to place those funds in a retirement account rather than claim them as ordinary income. That was approved by the federal government, which is terrific for all the other states where one can go back and amend one's returns from 2007. We can't do that here in Minnesota. Our statute doesn't provide for that. What this would allow for, Mr. Chair, is a very simple allowance so that those specifically in this category would be able to go back and amend their Minnesota return as well. There is a revenue note that demonstrates or indicates up to a $1.4 million impact. I believe that would be reflective of if everybody from Northwest who's in this situation were to go back and amend their returns to make this change. Mr. Chair, I believe that is a reasonable overview of the bill. Captain Adler brought this issue to my attention as soon as it passed in Washington, and I'd be appreciative if the committee would hear a few words from him, and certainly if I messed up any of the details, I believe that he'll be able to fix them for you.
Okay, that would be rare, Representative Atkins, that you would mess up any details, and you certainly have an all-star cast of authors on this bill, I can see. So with that, is there any, we will go to the captain, and then we will go to House Fiscal. Is there anyone else in the audience that would wish to testify on behalf of the Atkins-Davids bill, or is there anyone that has concerns with the Atkins-Davids bill? I don't see any. Okay. With that, Captain, if you could please state your name for the record and who you represent, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bruce Sennler. I'm a captain of Delta Airlines, and I represent airline employees throughout the state of Minnesota.
Could you please spell your last name, sir?
E-N-D-L-E-R.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. A little bit more history than what Representative Atkins gave you is that for many of us in the business, we consider the last decade following 2001 and 9/11 to be the lost decade. We lost pensions, we lost income, and saw major contractions and a change to our mandatory retirement age, which resulted in stagnation. immediately upon entering and receiving bankruptcy note and claims, we went to the U.S. legislature asking for changes rather than taxing those notes and claims as ordinary income. And in 2008, we did receive a minor benefit in that we could put those proceeds into a Roth IRA. We began immediately trying to improve that particular benefit and tried a number of vehicles, as you all are aware. You put it on whatever vehicle you're able to put it on, and it took until this year in the FAA Modernization and Reform Act to finally get that passed. However, that lengthy time period resulted in the inability to recoup those proceeds at the state level because of the 3.5-year statute of limitations on an amended tax return. As Representative Atkins mentioned, we are simply looking for conformity with U.S. federal law for our members that reside in the state of Minnesota so that they can avail themselves of those, recoup those particular proceeds as well.
Captain, how far back can Minnesota go? If you're in Minnesota, how far back can you go?
To the best of my knowledge, it is 3.5 years.
3.5 years. And Mr. Michael, where'd they get the half year? I've never heard of such a thing.
Mr. Chairman, that's the standard statute of limitations, or not statute, it's not a statute of limitations, but how long tax filings are open in order to file amended returns, and so that's just standard in the income tax world. And actually what's at issue here is, in addition to that time limit, the legislature needs to change the law and authorize these amounts to be put into to contributed to an IRA to qualify to. So it's both of those effects, that you have to open up the ability to file amended returns for those closed tax years and to allow treatment of these these payments as contributions to IRAs.
So, Mr. Michael, this bill specifically is towards qualified airline employees. We're not opening it up to the whole world.
Correct, Mr. Chairman. It's only these settlement payments that were made as part of the bankruptcy that are affected.
Okay, questions for the captain? Representative Depke?
Yes, Captain, could you tell me about how many...
Representative Depke, your microphone, please.
I apologize, Mr. Chair. Captain, could you tell me approximately how many employees are affected by this bill?
Captain Endler?
Mr. Chair, Representative Depke, unfortunately, I don't have that information because it is all employees for all major carriers that file bankruptcy, and I only happen to work for one of those. Delta Airlines, Northwest Airlines, United Airlines, U.S. Airways, all have employees that receive bankruptcy notes and claims, so I do not have an absolute number.
Representative Depke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, with Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, just curious about what Representative Atkins, does Delta have no responsibility in this?
Representative Atkins.
In making this whole?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Paymar. Delta is the successor. It was actually Northwest Airlines that has made payments. There's no question that the payments have already been made. Northwest did that. They took responsibility for that. They made those payments. How those payments were categorized is at issue here, and Northwest has no control over that. That was solely at the time a function of what was available to those employees that took these payments, that they could only be taken as ordinary income rather than be placed into a retirement account.
Representative Paymar?
No, I was curious.
Captain?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, what essentially happened was that when out of the bankruptcy process, employees received either notes or claims for a certain amount because of termination or freezing of pensions and because of dramatic reductions in income. Those payments were initially used to fill up retirement accounts up to 415C limits, but in many cases exceeded those 415C limits and then were taxed at ordinary income.
Representative Paymar?
Thank you. No,
so, Captain, they received the federal benefit. They could move it that way, but they didn't receive the state benefit. So this is basically conforming with the feds.
Would
it be
correct.
Safe to say that?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, if there's no other questions for the captain, why don't we go to House Fiscal? Thank you, Captain. Ms. Templin?
Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. I'm looking at the revenue estimate for House File 2773, dated March 19th. And you see an estimated revenue loss in fiscal 13 for this proposal, of, as Representative Atkins stated, $1.4 million. in fiscal 13 and 20,000 in fiscal 14. And these costs are the difference between the settlement payments that taxpayers had in a taxable account compared to having them roll over, having them being rolled over to a traditional IRA. And Representative Depke did ask about the number of taxpayers affected, and Revenue made an assumption that about 10% of the settlement payments that were previously subject to Minnesota tax would be rolled over into a traditional IRA. So that just kind of gives us a kind of ballpark estimate about of how many taxpayers could be affected.
Ms. Templin, would the revenue note possibly be a bit high? Because I'm thinking a lot of folks might not even go back to do this. I can see if it's a larger amount, they may do this, but I think it's probably kind of a worst-case scenario. I don't really think it would be that much, Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair, it's this is an estimate made by the department's research staff based on the resources that they have. I certainly can go back and we can check on that estimate, on that assumption, and I can follow up with you.
Well, Ms. Templin, isn't the assumption by the department that everybody is going to go take advantage of this?
Mr. Chair, the assumption is that if you look on page 2 of your estimate, it says that 10%, or they assume that 10% of the payments that were previously subject to the Minnesota tax would be rolled over into a traditional IRA. And that, I think, is the what's driving the estimate, is that assumption of 10%.
Well, Ms. Templin, they would have had to have this, the pilots or employees being affected by this, they would have to have rolled it to an IRA, and so they had the federal deduction, but they wouldn't have had the state deduction.
Correct.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, under the recently passed federal legislation, they have a six-month period in order to do this, and so it's a future decision that we're dealing with here, not something that occurred in the past. So we don't, the Revenue Department does not know what the behavior will be. I don't think anybody does. It will depend upon decisions by a lot of airline employees that got these claims and payments.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, it's 180 days of the bill's enactment date that they have to make this decision.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions for Ms. Templin? Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Templin. Anyone else that would wish to testify on behalf of or with concerns on the bill? If not, if you'd like to wrap it up, or some Atkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd appreciate your support for the Atkins-David bill, and thanks, Senator Daley, who's also been moving this in the Senate.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. So I will move that we lay House File 2773 as amended over for possible inclusion in omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, member.
Okay, item next, Representative Mack. Representative Mack will move House File 2916. Representative Mack, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, House File 2916 is a bill that deals with a very important issue of eating disorders. Members, last year we voted to do a phase out of the provider tax that our providers across the state pay. And members, what this bill does is it comes along and tries to speed that up for programs, non-hospital-based programs that treat eating disorders. And members, the other issue that this bill addresses is it tries to just tailor the language that has to do with the tax credit that's available to institutions that do research, making sure that that credit is available for those that are partnering with a public or private higher education institution. And so, members, my goal in this is to try to equip and come alongside those programs that are doing good work in treating eating disorders, which far too often is a fatal disorder in this state. And so I don't want to take too much time, Mr. Chair. I do have some testifiers that are experts in this area and can speak very, very well to what this bill would do for them and what they're trying to accomplish in our community. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to our testifiers.
Okay, thank you, Representative Mack. Before we go with that, we have several folks that wish to testify on behalf of the bill. Is there anyone that wishes to testify with concerns on the bill? Do your testifiers know what that means? Okay, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Jillian Lampert, and I'm the Director of Communication, Outreach, and Research for the MLE program.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm here today to support this bill because it does take a giant step towards helping people who help people with eating disorders. The MLE program has provided exceptional personalized eating disorder treatment since 1993. Our mission is to provide individualized care leading to recovery from eating disorders. We provide comprehensive psychological, nutritional, medical, and psychiatric care leading to recovery for eating disorders. Eating disorders happen to people in all walks of life. They do not discriminate by age, by race, by gender, by ethnicity. We see clients as young as 8. We see clients as old as 78. So it may be different than your typical idea of somebody with an eating disorder. Eating disorder treatment works and saves lives, but access to sufficient care remains a really significant problem for our state and certainly across the country. Approximately 200,000 Minnesotans struggle with an eating disorder, but only about 10% of them are actually able to seek treatment due to lack of awareness, insufficient well-informed healthcare resources in their area, geographic proximity to care, and insurance-related barriers, including inadequate authorization for care or lack of insurance. The MLE program is committed to improving this access to care and to supporting advancements in the treatment of eating disorders. Because of this, we provide over $2 million every year in scholarship care to help address inadequate insurance coverage of treatment, and we also support strong research partnerships with the University of Minnesota and other Minnesota universities and colleges to further understanding of eating disorders. So the MLE program is one of the few specialized eating disorder treatment programs in Minnesota. We are a non-hospital private organization. We have multiple outpatient offices across the metro area as well as in Duluth. We have two residential programs, the Anna Weston Houses in St. Paul. Treatment occurs at four different levels. I'll just briefly tell you about. There's outpatient treatment, which is a combination of individual psychotherapy, group therapy, nutrition counseling, family therapy, medical services, psychiatric services. All of our outpatient offices offer those range of services. The next step up is an intensive outpatient program, which is a 3 to 4 day a week program where people come in 3 hours a day and get a wide array of group therapy, nutrition services, supported meals, all meant to interrupt symptom use and restore their health. If that's not enough, we have intensive day program, which is the next step up. That's higher intensity, longer duration, more frequent visit days during the week, combining those similar modalities. And our intensive day program is offered at multiple locations. We have about 3,500 active clients across the MLE program locations. Our last level of care is the Anna Weston House, which is residential inpatient care. We have 26 beds in two different programs, and that's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week, medically intensive residential treatment for eating disorders. So why this legislation, why is it important to us? Many of us know personally or through friends, relatives, coworkers, the devastating mental and physical impacts of eating disorders. Estimates say that 50% of Americans know somebody with an eating disorder. Eating disorder treatment works, it saves lives, and yet people die. And that remains, this access remains a significant obstacle to care. So this bill for us incents further research and knowledge regarding the disease and its treatment in the form of tax credit for research conducted in conjunction with private and public institutions. And it also exempts the MLE program from the provider tax, which will help us to reduce the barriers to eating disorder treatment and allow us to devote more of our resources towards those 190,000 Minnesotans who probably aren't getting treatment and suffer from this horrific disease.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Lampert?
I have a question for the author when the testimony's over.
Okay, thank you, Representative Hortman. Questions for Ms. Lampert? Okay, we'll go on to Ms. Weston, president of the MLE program. And again, there is no one in opposition to this bill. Ms. Weston, please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Kitty Weston, president of the MLE Program Foundation and mother of a daughter who had an eating disorder. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. It's great to have this opportunity. I came today to be the voice of those 200,000 Minnesotans who Jillian mentioned that battle eating disorders, and also the hundreds and thousands of family members who battle right alongside them. I've been an advocate for the past 12 years, traveling the country, speaking about eating disorders, but mostly I'm here today because I want you to carefully consider H.R. 2916, because I know firsthand why it is so vitally important to make sure everyone with an eating disorder gets access to the care they need. In February 2000, my daughter Anna died of her eating disorder because she was unable to obtain adequate care during her five-year battle. Anna was a bright, spirited, amazing young woman who was just on the cusp of her adult life. She had so much potential. We adored Anna. And it is impossible to describe the almost unspeakable grief, shock, and terror of Anna's death. There are hundreds of reasons why Anna's death is almost unbearable. But one of the most important for all of us to remember and consider is that eating disorders are treatable. She died of a treatable illness. We know how to treat eating disorders, and we know what people need to recover from eating disorders. I am convinced that Anna would be alive today had she been able to access the full continuum of care, especially residential, like the Anna Weston House. There are few programs in the United States that are as comprehensive or as highly regarded as the Emily program. And I know that the Emily program has been more than generous and will do whatever is necessary to try to get everybody the care they need, which is evidenced by the over $2 million in charity care they give away each year to help people. I urge you to do your part to allow the Emily program to continue providing care to everyone who walks through their doors. It's the right thing to do. You cannot bring Anna back, but you can prevent other senseless deaths. The requests made today will save lives. You play a major role in making sure that the 200,000 Minnesotans with eating disorders get access to the care they need and deserve. You have the opportunity to prevent other needless deaths like Anna's. You have a role in making sure no other parents like Mark and I have to bury their daughter, their beloved daughter, because she died from a treatable illness and eating disorder. Thank you.
Questions for Ms. Weston? Thank you very much, Ms. Weston. Before we get into questions for the author, we'll go to House Fiscal. Thank you very much, Ms. Weston.
You're welcome.
Ms. Templin?
Hi, Mr. Chair, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. I'm looking at the revenue estimate for House File 2916, and this one is dated March 26th. And for the proposal to exempt from Minnesota Care Tax for payments received for inpatient and outpatient treatment of eating disorders, the estimated cost to the Health Care Access Fund is $1.7 million in fiscal 13 and $2 million in fiscal 14 and $3 million in fiscal 15.
Questions for Ms. Templin? Okay, thank you. Now questions for the author or Versa Mack?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to clarify something really quick. It did come to my attention. I'm hoping I can make an oral amendment to put in an effective date that we intended to have in there and have that effective date be July 1st of 2013.
Okay, members, you've heard the simple oral amendment. Any questions on the amendment? Hearing none, all fair say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, thank you, Ms. Templin. Questions for the author, Representative Portman?
And it might be more a question for Ms. Templin, but I'm looking at the language on lines 3.15 through 3.19, and the way I understand this is there's a credit for research, for certain research that's conducted, medical research, and it's a credit if you are a tax-exempt organization under 501c3. And then the proposed new language adds public or private higher education institutions doing specifically research on eating disorders. And I'm wondering, aren't the public and private higher education institutions already covered in the language that refers to 501c3 organizations?
Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair, I would defer to Mr. Michael on the legal aspects of the
if the higher education...
Could you please repeat the question, Rep. Hartman?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The credit we would be creating against the tax would be for public or private higher education institutions that do research for the purpose of treating eating disorders. But the language on 3.16 already provides an exemption for entities that are 501c3s. And aren't public or private higher education institutions already covered by the 501c3 language? What does this add?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hortman, yes, in direct response to your question, most private higher education institutions would be 501c3s. Public universities oftentimes will be governmental entities and not 501c3s. But I think perhaps the more important thing to focus on in that language is it says conducted in coordination with a public or private higher education institution. And so that may be the fact that essentially it's not necessarily conducted by the 501c3, but it can be conducted by someone else in coordination with. But the sponsors of the bill would probably be the better ones to explain why they're adding this additional qualifying path to the research credit. And the one other thing to point out is that there is a cap on the research credit, so this has the effect of could have the effect of reallocating that cap among the various different entities that do the research.
Representative Hartman?
Thank you. Then a further question probably for Mr. Michael. Then it would allow organizations that are not tax exempt, in other words, for-profit corporations that coordinate with a higher education institution to claim this credit.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hortman, it's a little difficult parsing the language exactly with the conjunctives, but I think it's potentially susceptible to the interpretation that you identify.
Representative Hartman?
Mr. Chair, my concern is just that if it's a nonprofit institution, it already has the exemption, so we're broadening the exemption to cover for-profit entities that work with higher education institutions. And then my other concern, and maybe the author can address this, of highlighting the issue of eating disorder specifically. It seems to me I could see, later this session or next year, then we get somebody who wants us to put comma mental illness, comma diabetes, comma cancer, comma heart disease. And so why treat one specific medical condition differently than all the others?
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hortman. I appreciate the question and understand that whenever we take one, we're trying to address one particular issue, that possibility always exists of, other folks that see this as an option for something that they can take on to. This is a issue that I've worked on in the past and understand the extreme difficulty in trying to get the treatment that's needed for something that is an extremely treatable disease. And so I'm just trying to get at that one aspect. Obviously, there is fiscal implications that go along with this. So I'm trying to get at one small area of something that's impacting our healthcare system in the state. And so that's kind of what I'm choosing to bite off for right now in this issue.
Representative Hartman? Representative Paymar?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess the second part of Representative Hortman's question was really where I was getting is, as worthy as this is, here, what's the precedent and what'll happen next year? I mean, I don't think there's a whole lot of people that really like the provider tax and wish that we could, we would have paid for care to low-income people in a different way, but it's there and it's getting phased out, but why wouldn't everyone just jump to the head of the line now and get their provider tax exempt for equally worthy health care service before the phase out starts? I guess Cindy, you didn't really have an answer for that except that you like this one better.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Paymar. Representative Paymar, not necessarily that I like this one better. This opportunity came to me. I think it's a worthy one to be a proponent of.
knowing folks that have dealt with this issue have gotten treatment that's been extremely effective. It's one that is important to me. And I guess really quick, Mr. Chair, if it's okay, I also just wanted to make a mention so that I don't forget. I have had a couple folks come to me with concerns about hospitals that provide treatment for this, that have a few concerns on them not being included. I am working with them. So just in full disclosure, I did want to make that known, and I'm more than willing to work with those folks who do have some concerns going forward. And to Representative Paymar, I don't know, I guess I can't predict the future in terms of other people will jump to the front of the line or if there's a definite answer that you're looking for there, but hopefully I was able to answer your question.
Well, I'm just Paymar. I just know there are a lot of dentists in my district that will be pleased to know that this is an avenue and have a bill, I'm sure, next legislative session.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's nice to see a bunch of our health lobbyist friends from Health and Human Services in the Tax Committee. And I think the warnings about the precedents here are to be well taken. The money that won't go into the Health Care Access Fund will not then be available in the Health and Human Services Committee, which hasn't considered this, to provide coverage to people who are currently insured through the Minnesota Care Fund, which the Health Care Access Fund is projected to have a zero balance, as I recall, at the end of this year. It isn't in a position financially, I don't think, to be exhibiting largesse, or at least we should understand what the implications are for people whose insurance coverage is dependent upon it. But and I am truly sympathetic with it. I've had someone I know and care a lot about who struggled with this as a young person. But, you know, I do think it is a slippery slope, and I could probably name off 100 different diagnosis groups that would be loved to have that break. But I am particularly concerned about the research credit, because I think the way it's written right now, in current law, it's a formal program of medical and healthcare research. And that was really done to make it be the very credible, you know, peer-reviewed research that affects whether or not a cure works or doesn't, that's done by our University of Minnesota and Mayo Clinic and those that have to meet really, really high standards of healthcare research designs. And putting the wording as coordinating with a public or private higher education institution, to me, just means you could have an undergraduate class of nursing students doing some work. It doesn't mean that it's the kind of research that leads to cures, that leads to the kind of insights that I think was considered deserving when this was put in law. And so while I am sympathetic to the cause, I would suggest that Representative Mack seek appropriations out of the Health and Human Services Committee rather than a diagnosis-based tax break.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I'm not on the Health and Human Services Committee, but is there a definition for eating disorders? I mean, I know there isn't one in this bill, but is there a defined in state law of some sort of what is an eating disorder?
Representative Mack.
Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt, thank you for the question. I actually just had that conversation with some folks right before coming. I am not aware of anything being defined currently in law. That is an area that if the next step down the road with this bill, if we were to move forward, to create some definition in this word for the word treatment that's in here and what would qualify under this.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Representative Mack, because that would be a concern of what could fall under eating disorder. We could, you know, be opening up quite a bit there. My other question, and I, you know, Mrs. Weston and gave very moving testimony, and you know, eating disorders is a very important topic. But I mean, I want to know, is in fact the 2% provider charge preventing care in this area? I mean is that really a stumbling block? And also the lack of a 2.5% research credit into this area really preventing credits? I guess the question is, I mean, will this do anything that isn't being done right now? I mean, if it is that serious and in fact care is being prevented because of this, I guess that would be good to know. I mean, is 2% making that
Ms. Lampert
big of a difference?
Mr. Chair, Representative, just if I can answer that question. Actually, I could answer a couple of your questions, maybe. I'm not aware of, back to the state statute question, if the eating disorder is defined in state language, I'm not aware of whether it is or it's not, but it is defined. It's defined by the American Psychiatric Association. It includes anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, and eating disorder not otherwise specified, which has very clear diagnostic language. So I understand your concern that perhaps it would lump in other things, but there is a medically established description of the diagnosis, and to your question about treatment levels, there are descriptions of that as well. So I think that concern maybe would be allayed. And the question about the is it preventing what the provider tax is preventing simply is helping us help more people. That if that provider tax relief were given, we could help more people who are uninsured or underinsured, and indeed even those people who are underinsured by our own programs to a certain degree, that we really will reinvest in helping people that can't get the care. That's our mission. So it is. There are many other things that are barriers to providing more care, but this is one of them.
Representative Markworth.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, we're going to go to House Fiscal at this point. We did the revenue note on this one? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. I'm just getting old. Ms. Von Mosch, if you'd like to come down. And then, members, it's my intention by 11:30 that we would go to the Myra bill and then talk about that. So we'd lay the MAC bill over, and then the Davids bill and the Kiffmeyer bill. That would be the order. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Susan Von Mosch with the Department of Revenue. I just want to testify briefly on an administrative issue that is highlighted in the revenue estimate. And it deals with the issue that the exemption would apply to all eating disorder treatments as the bill is currently written. So it isn't just focused on specific facilities or programs that provide this type of treatment. And because of the way it's worded right now, it could include a very large number of providers across a wide range of provider types. And this could make it very difficult to for the department to figure out what really would be exempted. If someone is going in to see a medical doctor or to get some service, they might be going in for one issue and it might end up being an eating disorder issue, and so it might require a provider to actually split the costs. And so the department would be supportive in trying to define a little bit better what the bill would cover and what the bill would exempt. And we'd be willing to work with Representative Mack in trying to do some of that work.
Okay, questions for Ms. Von Mosch? Thank you very much. Representative Mack moves that 2916 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus tax bill. Okay, Representative Myra. We'll start on the Davids bill, and we will lay that over as soon as Representative Myra is here to get to that bill. And then we also have a Kiffmeyer bill here. Okay, so I will move House File 2609. I have a couple folks. It would be laid over for possible. Well, I'll just move the bill so it's before us at this point. And so is there anyone that wishes to testify with concerns about this bill? Okay, first of all, I'll have Mr. Michael explain what I'm trying. I'll have Mr. Michael explain what I'm trying to do here. Then we'll have some very, very brief testimony. Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, right now most nursing homes and certified board care homes are already exempt under the current law, either as a publicly owned facility or as an entity organized and operated for charitable purposes. But there have been some issues raised, particularly as it relates to Under the Rainbow. And so I think this deals with just a very small subset that may not meet those definitions.
Okay. If you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I work with Aging Services of Minnesota, and I'm also here representing the Long-Term Care Imperative, and I'm joined by my colleague.
Mr. Chair, members, Toby Pearson with Care Providers of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, We first want to thank Representative Davids for bringing forward House File 2609. This is largely an issue that came to our attention late last year due to a change of interpretation, we believe, in how sales tax exemptions are granted and applied to nonprofit nursing homes. Ms. Dalton is correct that we believe that this arose after the Minnesota Supreme Court decision of Under the Rainbow was handed down a few years ago. And while that court decision dealt with property taxes, it dealt specifically with charitable exemptions for taxes in general. One of the main issues in Under the Rainbow was defining when a charity would qualify for exemptions, and one of the specific holdings in that case was that a charity had to give away services for free or at a reduced cost. On the property tax side, this was an issue we addressed in the legislature in the session immediately following Under the Rainbow. Nursing homes, nonprofit or for-profit, due to a state rate equalization law, are prohibited from giving away services for free or at a reduced cost. And so in the aftermath of Under the Rainbow, we did seek a specific property tax exemption for nonprofit nursing homes. We did not do so for sales taxes because we did not realize that we needed to do the same thing for sales taxes. But we're back again as the issue has now come up. As Ms. Dalton stated, the majority of nonprofit nursing homes already have a sales tax exemption, and this issue only came to light due to some changed interpretation in applying Under the Rainbow just this year. The language before you in House File 2609 identically mirrors the property tax exemption that we sought a few years ago. We have worked with the department, and we understand that this language would address those issues and not only maintain the sales tax exemption for those nonprofit nursing homes, but make it an equal playing field for all nonprofit nursing homes to qualify for this exemption.
Okay. Very briefly, Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair, members, very briefly, care provider supports it for nonprofit nursing homes.
Okay. If House Fiscal could come and go over the revenue note, please, and then possibly if House Fiscal, someone from House Fiscal could please explain how Mr. Bill got to the front table here with an Ohio State emblem. Ms. Templin, can you explain that?
Mr. Chair, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal staff. That was my partner in crime, and I'll leave that to her to do the explaining on that. I'll take the easy part and explain the revenue estimate for House File 2609. For the sales tax exemption for nursing homes as specified in the proposal, there's an estimated a general fund impact and legacy fund impact in fiscal 13 through fiscal 15 of an estimated revenue reduction of $10,000 per year. And my partner in crime is going to explain the rest.
To the revenue note and other questions.
Mr. Chair, Kathy Schill, House Fiscal. Mr. Chair and members, Mr. Bill has joined you at the table today. He is holding what is called a Block O, which stands for the Ohio State University.
The Ohio State University.
And he joined you at the table today because Ohio State made the Final Four in the NCAA tournament. And I know that my colleague, Mr. Rubis, is from Kansas, and we have this game that we will be playing, or at least rooting for our respective teams on Saturday.
I hope both teams do very well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the endorsement.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Markworth.
Mr. Chair, I have a feeling you did not talk to your committee administrator about allowing displays as such. I know his likeness for Syracuse, which Ohio State beat in the Elite Eight. So, Mr. Chair, just so you can handle that with your committee administrator.
Representative Grisnowski would be so kind as to just, you know, we have protocol here, kind of just put the, don't leave Mr. Bill alone, just.
Does it have the same meaning, Mr. Chair, like this?
That's a big O. Knocks him over. Oh, Mr. Bill.
He can't handle it.
Too tight. Okay. Now, where are we? Any questions for House Fiscal, Representative Rukavina?
Mr. Chair, is this basketball? You know, because on the range, when your baby's born, male or female, you put a hockey stick in one side of the room and a basketball in the other, and if they crawl towards the basketball, you hit them with the hockey stick.
Okay, I will move that House File 2609 be later for possible inclusion in a future tax omnibus bill. With that, Representative Myra, try and top that. Okay, Representative Myra, we'll move House File 2032. Please describe your bill. And first of all, for the Myra bill, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on behalf of or with concerns about the bill? Oh, we have a testifier. If you could please step down, sir. Representative Myra, welcome to your committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This is a really great bill. I'm bringing it on behalf of a business owner in my house district. What the bill seeks to do is modify sales tax on used car leases. Minnesota is one of only three states in the country that assesses sales tax on used car leases. And Minnesota is the only one of the three that assesses it all up front. In so doing, it really kills this line of business. So what we're trying to do in this bill, what we are doing in this bill, is taking the assessment of sales tax from all up front to a periodic payment. What this bill will do is it will provide more jobs for Minnesota because currently this line of business is not effective. It will also increase our state revenues, as my testifier will show in his diagram or chart in a little bit. Also, it provides better transportation options for the poor. Most of the individuals who lease used cars have very poor ratings, and so this is all they can afford, and so it gives them some more options. And also, through the leasing of these used cars, insurances are required on the leases, and so there will be more individuals that are going to be driving cars around Minnesota that have insurance. At this time, I'd like to present my testifier, Mr. Lynch.
Mr. Lynch, if you could state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
My name is Alan Lynch, and I represent Northland Auto Enterprises, Inc. in Burnsville, Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The program is designed for credit-challenged people that can't get funding anyplace else. They can't get bank financing. They can't get credit company financing. There's no place they can get financing. So they're forced to do one thing, and that's to buy a car off the street for somewhere between $500 and $3,000 at the maximum, probably. Those cars are taxed at $10 if they're under $3,000 and 10 years old. They're not always very reliable if you're buying a $500 or $1,000 car. This gives the customer a chance to have another option available here, and that's our lease-to-own program, our rent-to-owner lease-to-own program, where the customer can get the car from a dealer and get a little better car, pay for it, and if they run into financial trouble, they can bring the car back and walk away. The biggest problem with credit-challenged people is that when they purchase a vehicle and they can't pay for it, they get the car repossessed, and now they have a repossession on their credit, which makes it even tougher for them to get themselves straightened out. This takes all that away because they can bring the car back anytime they want, walk away. When they get back on their feet, they can come back and get another car. It's ideal program. I've been running it for 22 years nationwide. We have thousands of dealers that use this program nationwide. I have an example here in Louisiana. We have Louisiana last year collected $4.5 million in sales tax off our program on a monthly basis. Minnesota collected nothing because Minnesota, that customer cannot pay $600-$800 with the titling, the taxes, and all that up front. They have nothing left to get the car with. So they can't buy the car here, so the program doesn't work here in Minnesota.
Mr. Lynch, I believe the $4.5 million was on an annual basis. Monthly was $382,000.
Yes, on a monthly basis, $382,000, yeah, in Louisiana.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, correct. It's a terrific difference. I mean, it's huge. You know, I have a map in my office of the United States, and I have all these pins in there. I operate in a company in Minnesota. I have no pins in Minnesota. It looks kind of funny. People come to my office and say, what's wrong with Minnesota? I said, well, these customers can't afford to pay that. So it's just that simple.
Questions for Mr. Lynch, Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question's for whoever's going to go over the fiscal note.
Certainly, okay. Other questions for Mr. Lynch? Thank you very much, Mr. Lynch, for your testimony. House Fiscal, please.
Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. There is a revenue estimate for House File 2032, dated March 16th. And this proposal is estimated to have non-general fund impact to the Minnesota Transit account and the county state aid highway fund of $120,000 in fiscal 13. And that estimated revenue reduction loss is the difference between taxpayers, what they would be paying in sales tax in installments or down payments, versus what they would be paying up front. So that shows the, that is what you're seeing there is the cost.
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What it shows is a $60,000 hit to Greater Minnesota Transit in 2013 and a $60,000 hit to the County State Aid Highway Fund. And then in subsequent years, a continuing impact. And what I'm wondering for the author then is, have you tried to work with somebody at the department on the revenue estimate? Because if your testifier's testimony is right and people aren't doing these leases because of the way the tax is structured, you shouldn't show a hit to these funds. But as it is, showing that you're losing money for Greater Minnesota Transit and County State Aid Highways, it's kind of hard to say that a person would be in favor of hitting both those funds in these amounts.
Representative Myra.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my understanding is we can't estimate what it possibly could be, that dynamic projection. But from the experience that my testifier has had in other states, in, is it Louisiana?
Yes.
That is where they assess the tax on a periodic basis, whether it's monthly or weekly or whatever. And so they have that line of business. In Minnesota, we just simply can't do that business because it would require these people who are financially challenged to come up with between $700 to $1,100 of sales tax all up front when they go to do it. Otherwise, they can do it on a monthly basis, and it's much, much more manageable, and so it becomes a line of business that they can do.
Ms. Templin, to that point?
Mr. Chair, also, in the revenue estimate, you're only seeing 3 years of revenue impact, and you're seeing an estimated revenue loss over 3 years. And I think that the revenue estimate, if it were to show 5 or 6 years, the cost would go down to zero, because it's kind of like a shift in the sales tax payment. Instead of paying it all up front, you're paying it over. You know, 5 or 6 years, so that the net is probably, you know, zero over time.
Representative Hartman.
excuse me, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm just suggesting, Representative Myra, that if what you're saying is true, then the revenue estimate is inaccurate. And so if you think, and your testifier thinks, that there should be a net positive to the state's budget, then you need to work on getting the fiscal note changed. But as it is, the fiscal note is what it is, so right now it shows a hit to funds. And Greater Minnesota Transit right now doesn't cover anywhere near the demand that they have for their services. And so I think it'd be worth your time to talk to the Department of Revenue. If people aren't entering into these contracts because of the way we structured the tax, then it shouldn't show a hit. You know, you should work on the fiscal note.
Representative Myra.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Templin? Otherwise, we'll wrap it up and get to the final bill. Mr. Lynch?
I did an estimate here for you, and I did ask a question. I met with the tax people, and I asked a simple question. I said, how can you take no money and lose something from it? And they said that's the way the formula works. So I said, I'll make this simple. I said, I'll build you a little wooden box here, and I'll give it to you. And set it there, and next year I said, you call the police department and you say somebody stole $130,000 out of that box. The policeman's going to say how much was in the box. You said there was nothing in there. The first call he's going to make is the guys in the white jackets to come and get you. So I said, I think there's something wrong with the program that calculates that. I did an estimate here on the sheet showing that if we did, like we did in other states, if we did 756 cars in the next 3 years, Minnesota would take in $5.051 million in taxes on a monthly basis, taking it in
annual basis,
totally for 3 years. Yes, it's periodic. It's on a monthly basis.
Okay.
But I calculated at the end of each year. At the end of the first year, Minnesota would have taken $303,000. At the end of the second year, $1.4 million. And at the end of the third year, $3.3 million. Currently, you're taking in $10 a car, on $10 taxes on those cars. That's 760 cars times the $10 in the three-year, over the three-year term, selling the same number of cars. Minnesota took in $139,860.
Okay. And with that, Representative Meyer moves that House File 2032 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Sure.
Thank you. Representative Rukavina.
We're going to entertain the White Jacket Amendment. I like that.
No comment. Okay, so with that, thank you, Representative Meyer. Thank you, Mr. Lynch and Ms. Templin. Representative Kiffmeyer moves House File 1107. And we will go, we will be out of here by noon because I realize folks have caucuses and things such as that to go to. So with that, Representative Kiffmeyer, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for the opportunity to present this bill here. And this is a bill that just is got two purposes for me. In regards to this, Minnesota is at a competitive disadvantage. We have 30 other states that do not apply sales tax in this area. So we're uncompetitive, losing sales to other states. In addition, consumer protection. Matter of fact, in today's newspaper, there was a story again about a fraud issue that we are dealing with in regards to this. And part of the reason is because we're not able to have a competitive advantage for our Minnesota businesses. But, Mr. Chairman, that is the overall approach to the bill, but I have a testifier here today that can speak with greater knowledge about the matters before us.
Okay, Representative Kiffmeyer, is the A2 amendment yours?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Before we get going, is there anyone that wishes to testify with concerns on House File 1107 as amended? Okay, please state your name for the record, please, and provide your testimony.
Thank you. Okay. Representatives, there's also a packet being passed around of information for you on this bill. Thank you, Chairman Davids. My name is Gary Adkins. I'm a resident of Burnsville and a businessman from Edina. I'd like to thank you all for giving us this opportunity to speak on behalf of House File 1107, commonly known as the Bullion Bill or Exemption for Sales Tax on Coins and Precious Metals. Coins and precious metals are purchased for an investment, and like other investments, they should not be taxed. If you think about it, these items can change hands multiple times, and if taxed each time, the tax collected could eventually exceed the value of the item. Currently, 30 other states understand this fact and exempt products completely or have some type of de minimis exemption. Wisconsin is currently considering this exemption as well, and if passed there, Minnesota would be surrounded by states with exemptions for coins and precious metals. All the states surrounding us would have that exemption. We've provided you with a folder containing pertinent information for consideration in this bill. And two of the most important things you'll find in that folder, there's a map in there that shows all of the different states that have exemptions currently for coins and precious metals. Also, there is some historical data from the state of Michigan, who's had an exemption the longest, I believe, since 1999. And the results there, as a result of having exemption, it's created a lot of jobs. It's doubled the revenues to the state. So we believe this is more than just a revenue-neutral bill, that it's revenue-positive. It's a nonpartisan bill, and it provides many benefits when passed. HF 1107 will create business and jobs for the state of Minnesota. HF 1107 will provide enhanced consumer protection. HF 1107 will attract major conventions to Minnesota. It will create new revenue sources for Minnesota through income taxes as well as sales taxes from the residual effects of increasing business and hiring more people. The proposal will not lose revenue, but instead it will create alternative revenue sources from the growth of these businesses and jobs. And lastly, it'll provide a strong competitive advantage currently enjoyed by 30 other states. An interesting note is there's a coin club in southern Minnesota that currently holds their conventions 10 miles to the south in the state of Iowa because it's a tax-exempt state. And that's a sad note that we have to go to the state of Iowa to to do business. There's a great deal of support on this from the Minneapolis Visitors and Convention Bureau, who stands to create a great benefit for Minnesota by attracting thousands of unique visitors to our beautiful state. We're also supported by hundreds of Minnesota businesses and their employees who work in this industry, as well as thousands of collectors and investors throughout the state who will benefit greatly from this bill. Just a couple of weeks ago, we had a small convention at the Earl Brown Convention Center, and in one day, we collected 500 signatures on a petition to endorse this bill. I know Mary, Representative Kipmeyer has those signatures. We'd like to keep dollars in Minnesota, grow our economy, and support economic growth in our state, and we appreciate the opportunity to speak to you about that today. And Mr. Chairman, with your permission also, there are a couple members who were going to attend today that were not able to. I'd like to present testimony on their benefit or on their behalf if possible.
I don't think we're going to have time. I think we understand what this does. I do want to hear from House Fiscal on the revenue note. And Mr. Atkins, if you could stay there for questions. You're going to be the one representing the whole crew here. So, Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff again. I'm looking at the revenue estimate for House File 1107, dated March 19th. And the sales tax exemption for currency, coins, and bullion is estimated by the Department of Revenue to have an estimated revenue loss to the general fund of $870,000 in fiscal 13 and $1.1 million in fiscal 14 and $1.2 million in fiscal 15. There is also a legacy in fund impact as well. I am trying to, I guess just one other point about the revenue estimate is that the department assumes that 75% of all sales for these products would be greater, there would be purchases of greater than $1,000. And that is one of the provisions in the bill, that it would exempt purchases above $1,000.
Okay. Before we go to questions from Ms. Templin, Mr. Atkins, if you could provide that testimony in writing to committee members, we'd certainly like to see that.
Yes.
And that doesn't have to be right now, if you could just get it to us.
Just one quick note. We take exception to the revenue department's work on this project, and we obviously value their opinions and so on, but I think the revenue department doesn't totally understand the business itself or the industry. And I think there's a lot of, you know, based on the static scoring, in a sense, that's done by the revenue department, not dynamic scoring. And I think that a lot of this, a lot of the impact of this is diffused by the fact that it's going to create a lot of jobs, a lot of other revenue sources that we're not really identifying as you examine that the tax bill. So I think there's a lot to be gained by looking at those sources. And there is a copy of a rebuttal that we did to the tax department's estimates in your packages that you have today.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Atkins. Questions from Ms. Templin, Representative Dabney?
I have questions for others.
Okay, Representative Marquardt.
Just at the end.
Oh, okay. Any questions for Ms. Templin? Thank you, Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the packet you have in front of you, there is a Michigan study that was done on the fiscal impact, and so they have the longest history in there. And you will see that this was work that was done to kind of see what was that impact. There are several pages there that are well documented and well footnoted for your consideration as well to support what Mr. Atkins is saying.
Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer. Representative Dabney?
Mr. Chair, first of all, actually, I don't have any of that information in my packet.
It's in this booklet.
Representative Dabney, I think it's in the booklet that was passed out.
I didn't see that. Thank you. Okay.
Representative Dabney?
Mr. Chair, first question for you. Are we going, did I miss us doing the A2 amendment?
That was put on.
Yeah. That was put on. Okay. Boy, and I was here. Question for,
I didn't know we'd gone over a revenue note either, so we're even. Question for staff.
Thank you. For Ms. Dalton, just trying to understand exemptions to sales tax. If I buy stamps from a collector or for my collection, so not to use on an envelope, but as part of stamp collecting as opposed to coin collecting, do I pay sales tax on the value of those stamps?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, if you're not buying them from the U.S. Postal Service, yes, you would pay tax.
Representative Dabney?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Dalton, I always go through the Sunday ads looking for coupons. And in the back of one of those things, the coupons, they always have porcelain figurines. If they had a cute one this week of a little dachshund in a coffee cup. If I purchase that as a collector's item, it's really hard. If I buy the little dachshund in the teacup porcelain figurine, do I pay sales tax on that?
Well, that's where dachshunds belong, by the way. But anyways, Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
I'll be hearing about that on the email.
Shortly.
Ms. Dalton.
Yes, you would pay sales tax.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. Those collectible spoons you can find in gift stores, you know, from representing a state or a city or a country or whatever, do I pay sales tax on those?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, yes, you would.
Okay. Last question for staff, because I think I'm getting the trend line here. I've still got a basement full of duck decoys because my dad collected antique duck decoys, and he's been gone for a while, and I've got to call the folks who are going to help me get rid of them. But when I sell them to a collector, will they pay sales tax on that transaction?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, antiques are taxable unless you are a isolated and occasional sale, so you may not be subject to the sales tax.
Representative Dabney.
Okay. Then I know you don't like to this point, but to drill down a little
bit. Your own point, so you're fine.
Yes, it is. A little self-referential, but that's modern culture. If Dad had collected Kennedy half dollars, I think we've got a few of them around, actually, and I sold it to Mr. Atkins, I got six of them, and I sold them, that would not be a sales tax experience under current law because it would... I'm an occasional, you had some technical terminology, an occasional seller, and it's just kind of a side thing for our hobby.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, an isolated and occasional sale, if you are not in the business of selling the item, it would not be subject to sales tax, and there are definitions of isolated and occasional sale, but basically we think of this as the garage tax, the garage sale exemption. Okay.
Here's right. Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Atkins, do you have documentation from Meet Minneapolis as to their support for the bill?
Yes, that's included
here?
Also Mr. in Atkins. Your package.
Okay.
Here's Mr. Dabney.
We also.
All right.
Here's Mr. Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just have a hard time choosing one hobby over another and saying, you know, I would imagine that if you went to a duck decoy convention, you could get 500 signatures saying, don't apply the sales tax to my hobby either. But
we don't.
I'll leave it at that.
Representative Marquardt, then we're going to wrap it up.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Just, I guess, one comment on this, and, you know, and it's a matter of priorities. I mean, money is tight around here, so tight that we're looking at cutting the renter's credit. And here we're looking at providing tax breaks for coin collectors. I just really have a problem with the priorities here. That's it.
If you want to wrap it up, Representative Kiffmeyer?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is not about the coin collectors. This is about the small businesses. This is very similar to a gas station. But we are coming forward here as small business people. And they are the ones that would be like the gas station owner, not the one that drives up in a BMW to purchase or a big truck to purchase, nor are they the gas company or the oil company providing the gas. This is the gas station, regular Joes who are in a small business and are finding that those who can go to other states. In other words, for purchases under $1,000, you would make that purchase, and Representative Dabney, under this bill, those purchases also would be taxed. But those folks who might be looking at an investment similar to like a mutual fund situation where they are doing this on an investment purpose, not just small things and hobby type things, but as an actual investment, they will go to Texas, they'll go to Iowa, they'll go to North Dakota, they'll go to South Dakota. Because for them, going there is cheaper, as we all would do, to be able to go make that purchase in another state where they do not charge sales tax. Because they go there, there's also grocery stores, there's restaurants, there's gas stations and other things as well that they make use of along the way that they are not doing in Minnesota. This is a small business bill that promotes jobs and keeps our sales in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kiffmeyer renews her motion that House File 1107 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus tax bill. Members, no tax committee tomorrow. The next tax committee will be Thursday, 10:15 a.m. Agenda to be announced, so please look at your emails. And location to be announced also. With that, good government all the time. Thank you for your work, members and staff. We are adjourned.
Thank you.